Again, to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and with me today is a very special guest, Larkin Rose. And the odds are, if you listen to my podcast, you already know who Larkin Rose is, and it's completely unnecessary for me to introduce him. But in case you are new to the podcast, or in case you've been living under a rock somewhere in some communist country, Larkin Rose is an author, and we'll pitch some of his books here in a minute. But the best way to get to know Larkin Rose is to get over to YouTube and just search for Larkin Rose. And you're going to find stuff that's going to blow your mind. Larkin, thank you very much for coming on the show with me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome to BadQuaker.com.
It's great to be on.
You were there's so many things I could talk to you about. You were at Libertopia, so tell us about that first.
That was fun. That's an annual event of almost entirely voluntarists and anarchists. There's a few minarchists still clinging for dear life to their superstitions. But it's interesting that it's so overwhelmingly people who are into the advanced stuff. It's a very upscale event at this fancy place in San Diego. And there's all sorts of information and talks and events going on. And it's sort of it's in sharp contrast to Porkfest, the Porcupine Freedom Festival that happens in New Hampshire, which is sort of Woodstock with guns, which is also really fun. I also really like it, but it's a very different setting at Libertopia because it's very upscale and respectable. I mean, you have Stefan Molyneux is there and David Friedman and lots and lots of people who are way more respectable than me, which isn't saying much. But that was great to get there. I didn't think I was going to, but somebody helped chip in for a train ticket because I don't fly the fascist skies anymore. So I got there and that was a blast. It's fun to be around people who, like, you don't have to start with the third grade level explanation of things. They already get the general ideas, and then they actually have useful discussions about some of the details and practical solutions and things like that. And so that's a change from the usual thing of trying to deprogram people from step one out of the lies they've been taught to believe.
Well, now you are kind of an expert at that. You've been doing I don't know if you'd call it a nationwide tour, but you had a thing where you went to several cities, and you did a thing specifically in that mode of trying to break that shell and get a person who hasn't necessarily opened their eyes to cut the stitches away that where their eyes are sewed shut and get them to actually see the monster that is the state.
Yeah. And it's a thing I call escaping the myth. Did one in Michigan, just did one in Colorado, and it's 95% human psychology and 5% the actual issue. Because as as lots of your listeners will know, when you try to approach somebody and get them to start contemplating life as a free human being who owns himself, you get all sorts of weird emotional reactions because the belief of statism does not come from evidence and rational thought and deduction. It comes from faith-based indoctrination into the cult of government. And so trying to literally deprogram people freak out because it's something they become attached to psychologically. It's not like telling them, hey, you should have a automatic transmission instead of a manual transmission. It's not something most people can just think about rationally. And so for the last 16 years, I've accidentally learned a whole lot about human psychology and how to try to get ideas past all the instinctive, knee-jerk, irrational freakouts that people have when they start to glimpse the idea of reality as completely different from what they've ever heard. A reality where there really is just a big planet with lots and lots of people who are equals and have to interact as adults, instead of there's a giant ruling class with a master plan that tells us all what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get people to think about that without freaking out has been the biggest challenge. As soon as somebody comes to the point where they can talk about it without running out of the room or screaming or having tantrums, great. Then it's just intellectual. The rest is pretty darn easy. But to me, the main obstacle, and it was true of me too, because I was raised statist and did plenty of intellectual kicking and screaming on my way to giving that up. And so I use myself as a guinea pig, is how do you get people to think about these things without getting emotional and angry and confrontational? And I think Escaping the Myth finally did that. I mean, the two I just did, nobody got offended. Nobody felt uncomfortable. There was no arguing. There was no fighting. There was no getting angry. And it seems to work. I still have to do the follow-up from the one in Colorado, and because I want to ask people sort of gently, what did you think about it? What did you like? What did you not like? And things like that. But so far, it's worked 100%, and then it doesn't make people get defensive and start screaming at you.
I've said before that it's kind of like, and I don't mean to call statists or people who believe in the state, I don't mean to call them children or anything, but it's very much like trying to get a pacifier away from a baby or a security blanket away from a young child. They always have this thing. There's always something that they hold in their mind as being so important that only the state can provide that for them. And you can take away a lot of the other things, but when you get to that pacifier, when you touch that one holy object that is just, you know, it's the center of it's the center of their myth, it's the center of their religion, that temple, when you touch that thing, the swords come out.
Yeah, and they completely freak out and get defensive, and it's a different thing for different people. And I know some people who are constitutionalists, for example, who say government should have nothing to do with caring for the poor and regulating commerce and blah, 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 and this huge list of things it should have nothing to do with, and then say, but we need it to be the military. And so I know people who say, you know, they'll spend 99% of their time explaining perfectly rationally why government doing all these other things is illegitimate and immoral and inefficient, does a bad job, and is destructive. But that one little thing that they're so convinced that the world would just come unraveled if government wasn't doing that one thing, they'll just cling to it tightly and kick and scream and suddenly imagine that government is efficient and useful and necessary in this one little field, and just won't give it up for years and years, if ever. And it is just a psychological attachment thing, because they've never imagined a world without that being the case. And, you know, for some people it's, you know, well, if government didn't provide the food, we'd all starve to death. Now, Americans don't think that, because we've seen quote unquote anarchistic food production. You know, it has the tentacles of government kind of getting in the way, but nobody's being forced to feed anybody, but it works pretty darn well. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to defense or roads or whatever somebody's pet authoritarian excuse is, they have a really hard time imagining not having a giant nanny state making sure that little piece of society works. So they'll kick and scream at the idea that we could just do it as people. We don't need a ruling class. We don't need to all be extorted and controlled for our own good. We could just be people. But yeah, different people have different little pet worries that they cling to the superstition of authority because of, that they just think, well, we have to have it for that. And I did that myself for years and years. And now looking back, I'm kind of embarrassed about it. but I try to use that to help other people let go of what really is just a horribly dangerous superstition. It feels comfortable, but it does not make humanity safer or better off.
One of your more recent YouTube videos I thought was just, it was so good on so many different levels, but it's the plantation argument. And man, you knocked that one right out of the park.
The Jones Plantation. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
And someone else did the illustration and someone else actually did the narration. I just wrote it and made them do all the work. But yeah, if you go to youtube.com/LarkinRose, all my videos are there. And the Jones Plantation, I really like the way the animation and the narration all came together. And the funny thing is, it's obviously an analogy to current society, but the video doesn't even bother pointing that out. Like, everybody right. can obviously recognize, wow, this is what we have. And some people even complain and say, this isn't what we have. And I say, well, who said it was? Like, you obviously recognize that this is a little too familiar to be comfortable. And so, yeah, that was a fun one to do.
The gentleman that does the voice on that is really good too. His voice just matches that video so perfectly.
Yeah. He's a guy who happens to be on my list and has done voiceover work for years professionally. Actually, I have him roped in to do a couple more coming up, 'cause yeah, he does a great job.
Another one that I wanted to mention was the Tiny Dot, because that just, especially in an election year like this, it really drives home the point that Tiny Dot doesn't have the kind of authority and power that people perceive that it has.
Right. It just it basically graphically represents the difference between the number of people bossing us around and the number of people being bossed around, specifically when it comes to federal taxation. And when you actually see the difference, it just becomes ridiculous. That video actually came out of a little talk I did over at Drexel years ago, and I did it on paper where, you know, here's this huge bunch of dots. Here's the number of people who are handing over their money to the federal government. And then here's the dot on a different piece of paper that represents how many people are demanding our money, all the members of Congress. And it usually takes people about 3 minutes to find the dot on the piece of paper in their hands that represents the number of people demanding money from us. And if you just see the relationship, it instantly strikes you that why do we ask them whether we're allowed to keep our own money? It's so ridiculous. Yeah, a lot of my videos are very, you know, very simple point. Like, I don't try to explain the whole world in a video. Basically, I just pick one little way to poke a hole in somebody's paradigm and hope they think about it some more.
Now, you mentioned air travel, and I myself have decided that I will not fly again, period. That's just not going to happen. I mean, you know, maybe after I'm dead, relatives might want to be mean to me and fly me somewhere or something, you know, out of a cruel joke. But if I have any choice, or if I'm hauled away by my heels, you know, by the evil overlords, and they decide to fly me somewhere, I won't have a choice in it. But if it's a decision that I have an influence in, I won't be flying again, period. The last time I flew was pre 9/11, and I couldn't even tolerate the procedures then. So I definitely can't handle going through, you know, what you have to go through now. But you had mentioned that railroad travel is not as bad. How intrusive were they with you?
Not at all, but partly that's luck. You know, I've heard stories of the TSA starting to show up at you know, train stations, and I don't know how often that's happened. I just heard sort of anecdotal stories. Didn't happen at all with me. I mean, there was no search of my luggage, and yeah, years ago, and you're probably one of the few people who also did this. I was already saying, look, when you get on a plane, they don't have the right to rummage through your luggage. I know they do it. Right. And everybody says, well, if it saves one life, yada, yada, yada. Well, if you throw the principle out the window and say, we get to treat everybody as a criminal by default and search them and stop them and interrogate them, like, you already gave up the only principle that matters. And there is no line between that and just living in a cage at yeah. which you have any principled objection. And sure enough, it's been wandering down that road to now you get treated like a complete terrorist because you want to be on a plane, and there, you get e-stripped and all sorts of nasty stuff. Yeah. And I don't even, you know, people say, well, it's not that bad to go through it. I don't refuse to go through it because I just couldn't stand going through that. I kind of think, who cares on a practical level, but I won't play along. I won't act as if it's okay. And there's no way I would go through that without making some comment that would get me arrested. Because yeah, if people treat me like that, I'm not going to treat them like it's okay that they're doing that. So I just don't go anywhere near it.
Yeah, that's exactly my position. I'd go in there healthy and happy, and they would begin groping me, and they would have to end up tasing me, spraying me, and hauling me out feet first.
Right, and since you know that, it's better to just avoid it.
Right. I'm not a supporter of martyrdom. Let's put it that way. Uh-huh. Now, Larkin, I missed you at Pork Fest. I knew you were down there, but I was up to my ears and things going on, so I wasn't able to get down and see you. But you had a pretty good crowd at Pork Fest, and you made a pretty good impact there. What did you think about Pork Fest?
It's fun. It's always fun just to be around that many people who don't want me forcibly robbed and controlled. Of course, it's not all voluntarist, all anarchist, whatever, but it's heavily in that direction, especially in the last few years. I mean, I remember when those who wanted no state were a tiny little minority at Pork Fest, and it wasn't that long ago, and now it seems to be that the majority have given that up. So, yeah, that was a fun crowd, and I delivered a sermon, which some people liked. From the First Church of Government, and that's on YouTube too. And luckily, the crowd there seemed to understand what I was doing and understand the point, so I didn't get lynched or anything.
There was no stoning done.
No, huh? No, I ran away quickly afterwards. So.
No burnings. Oh boy, yeah. I really liked Pork Fest a lot. It was very laid back and very relaxed. You know, the distance driving wasn't so great, but, you know, it was well worth the sacrifice.
Huh. Yeah, for me, compared to San Diego, Pork Fest is next door because I'm in Pennsylvania. Yeah. So,
but you still have to drive across New York.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Even New Jersey, I hold my nose and floor it through New Jersey and hope I don't get accosted by fascists.
I'm going to pause this and save the file. And folks, you're going to hear a commercial break, and we'll be right back with you.
Folks, I want to talk to you about Survival Gear Bags. Survival Gear Bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need.
Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Larkin Rose is with me on the podcast today, and Larkin... I'm sure you're a registered voter and you can't wait to get down there on November, whatever it is, and do whatever it is that they're supposed to do. I'm sure that you're entirely enthusiastic about that, right?
Of course. Your vote is your voice and you have to participate. Oh, man. As it happens, in Libertopia, we just had a fun panel discussion of to vote or not to vote. Stefan Molyneux and I were obviously on the not to vote side, and three people, including the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, were on the vote side. And that was rather eye-opening. That's already posted online by somebody. That audio isn't the greatest because it's just a camcorder with a mic. But yeah, that got into the whole game of democracy and what a joke it is. I mean, it's the tyrant's best friend. when you can mm-hmm. convince the people, when you can give them something to do, to bash their head against the wall so that they imagine they have some power without them actually having any power or any say or any influence whatsoever. I mean, that's the tyrant's dream come true. Because if the tyrant just came out and said, we're going to rule you because, duh, we can, then people get angry and they revolt and things like that. But if you say, hey, we're representing you, we're serving you, you chose us, when you can convince people of that lie, you can get away with almost anything. You can do whatever you want to them and just say, hey, this is what you voted for. We're just representing you as we stomp on you and take your money. And so it really, but there's still people who imagine that if you don't vote, you're doing nothing. They really, they talk that way on at the one of the, you know, the Judge Jim Gray, the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, talked as if your choices are vote or do nothing. And to me, voting is considerably worse than doing nothing, but I'm not for doing nothing either. But at least doing nothing doesn't legitimize your own enslavement. It doesn't say, yes, I condone this game, and yes, I agree that whoever gets the most buttons pushed next to his name has the right to rule me. So it's worse than nothing. But a lot of people, because they see, you know, you have to participate in the process, they see that as their only option. Yay, my power is I can go into a booth once every few years and vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee. And I feel so empowered. It's just, it's sad.
What you're saying there is not in theory either. An example of that, there's another YouTube, a good series of YouTubes is by a guy named Jan Helfield, I think.
Yeah.
And he interviews Harry Reid. And Harry Reid tries to make the argument in the interview that the taxation is voluntary.
Right.
And you can see in the interview, you know, it's a real twisting of logic, but you can understand how they justify their position, because after all, you vote. If you vote, then obviously you're part of the system and you're volunteering to be a part of the system. Therefore, taxation is voluntary. And how dare you complain about it?
Right. And they have to build up this twisted, bizarre mythology to make it sound legitimate. I mean, it used to be they just say, well, God told me I was king. People went, oh, mm-hmm. ooh, ah, okay, here's my money. That doesn't work anymore. They had to come up with a more complicated lie. And it's actually, it's more complicated and convoluted, but it's less rational than God made me, because at least that's kind of hard to disprove. But now they're saying, well, we made ourselves gods by we wrote these documents and did these pseudo-religious rituals and ran around circles and did dances and ta-da, now we have the right to rule you. And there wasn't even a deity involved. How did you do that? How did a human being manage to bestow upon himself the right to steal and attack and assault and do all that? But you make the lie complicated enough, and most people think, oh, well, it's just beyond my comprehension, so it must be valid, because look at all the well-dressed people on TV telling me it's valid. And mm-hmm. yeah, so a lot of what I do is explaining things at what should be like a third-grade level understanding, because the truth is painfully simple in this case. It's only the lie that's hugely convoluted and twisted to try to rationalize one group of people violently dominating another. The truth of, you know, you own yourself and it's not okay to initiate violence against other people. These are not advanced, complicated concepts, but which is why it takes years to pound into our heads the idea that, oh, there's an exception for this magical thing called government. It's allowed to. It has superhuman rights. It's not bound by morality. It's allowed to steal. In fact, it has to steal or there would be chaos and mayhem.
Yeah.
And it's just deprogramming by explaining things to people that, you know, every 5-year-old should be able to understand. It's a weird experience.
Yeah, but, you know, as you've probably seen over and over, when you can clearly speak the truth to someone, unless they're just entirely engulfed in the myth, when you speak the truth to someone who is actually seeking the truth, it kind of has a true ring to them. It's kind of like the difference between hearing, even if you're not musical, you hear something that's out of key as opposed to something that's in key. And even the non-musical person knows the difference in the two sounds.
Right. And there are a lot of people that I describe as default anarchists who tell me, like, they'll read my book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, and they'll say, I kind of instinctively knew all that, but, you know, to hear it put that way and kind of clarify it in my own head was cool. Like, just like what you said, they hear it, they know it's true, and they just sort of, oh, okay, I never quite heard it that way, but obviously that's what I believe, that's what I think society should be, that's how I live my own life, and things like that. So it's just, yeah, it's a matter of you put the simple truth in front of people, and then it's just the question of, will they dare to look at it or not? And that's the one thing that just completely baffles me. I don't know, I don't even know why I didn't do it myself for so long, and then why I did. What makes people suddenly decide to consider re-examining their assumptions? I don't know why people do that, and I don't know why people don't do that. But it seems to just be an individual switch. Some people suddenly dare to start thinking about it, and then it's from then on, it's just, you know, rational discussion. And some people just cling to their superstitions for dear life, even when it's not doing them any good. And I don't know what made me eventually throw the switch, because I was a statist for years, and I don't know what makes anybody do it. I don't even see a relationship between intelligence or education and the ability to do that. It just seems to be either someone decides to think or they don't.
Frank Charteroff, back 50 years ago, Frank Charteroff said almost the exact words that you just used. He said that it didn't seem to him to matter if a person was, you know, highly educated or no education at all, or from a rich background or a poor background. None of those things were a factor. Either a person got liberty or they didn't. He said, one of his quotes, that we're not trying to teach people, we're trying to discover them.
Yeah, that's good. And what, all I can do is stick ideas in front of people to say, look, here's the path I eventually walk down. Look at it and decide if you want to walk down it. And it's very different, especially in the Escaping the Myth events I do, where it's very heavily focused on, you don't have to believe me. You don't have to trust me. I'm not like taking an idea and trying to pound it into your head. I'm asking you to look at your own ideas, your own assumptions, and you decide when there's a conflict, and you decide what to do about it when there is. So that it really is just let the person out, like let the person out of his superstitions and indoctrination so they can just be themselves. It's not, here, I'm going to take my ideas and bash them into your head, which is what politicians do. It's what authoritarians always do. And I try to do the exact opposite. Just, you know, I don't expect people to adopt my values, but just look at your own and see if your beliefs and your actions are consistent with your own values. And for every statist, the answer is no, they aren't consistent. And that was true of me when I was a statist too. And that's why eventually I gave it up, because I didn't want inconsistencies inside my own head.
Now, we have about 10 minutes left in this segment, and you mentioned the name of your latest book. Why don't you tell us about that and what the name means? Well, you kind of have already, but go ahead.
Right. The book is called The Most Dangerous Superstition. It's the most important thing I've ever written, probably the most important thing I ever will write. I actually dragged my feet for 15 years knowing I had to write this book, but wanting to wait until I could do the best job I could. It totally digs to the crux of the issue, which is the belief in authority, which is the foundation of the belief in government. Once upon a time, churches claimed to be the authority that had the right to rule and punish sinners and stuff. These days, it's almost always done in the name of government. But the underlying thing is the same, the idea of authority, the idea that you can have an obligation to bow to something outside of yourself. That something outside of you telling what to do should ever supersede your own judgment and your own decision-making process. And that idea is in everything of our society, in all the terminology of government and law and courts and representation and crime and all sorts of mythology that we're taught. And the book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, basically digs down to the root and yanks it out. And says the belief in authority is not at all rational. It's not at all sane. It's not at all real. There cannot be an external thing that has the right to rule you, and there cannot be an external thing that you have an obligation to obey over your own conscience and your own judgment. And that, you know, the statement sounds pretty simple and easy, but it gets into all the ramifications of what that means, and it shows why the belief in authority, you know, we're taught that, well, that's what keeps us civilized and makes it so we can get along. It's the absolute opposite of that. The belief in authority is the most dangerous thing that society has ever known, because it leads otherwise good people to advocate and condone and commit mass evil all over the place. And the book goes through lots of examples. You know, one obvious example is I can't think of anybody who's robbed me directly on their own, but almost everybody I know has voted for somebody else to rob me, because they think when government does it, it doesn't count as robbery. And so when the victims of authoritarian control imagine authority to be legitimate, they hurt themselves and everybody else. It's really easy to point at people in power and say, they're the bad guys, they're hurting us. But the truth of the matter is, the perception of the subject class provides all of the power of the tyrants. If we didn't hallucinate them to be authority, they would have zero power. They wouldn't even have any enforcers, because the enforcers imagine the authority too, which is why they go and stomp on people and tase people, because, hey, you disobeyed the masters, so you must be bad and we must be law enforcers. And so just that the fact that the problem is not a particular regime or any piece of legislation in particular, it's the fact that most people imagine that there can be an outside authority, imagine that government can actually be something legitimate. And when that superstition falls away, suddenly the world looks completely different. You know, I know it did for me, and most of the people I know, where suddenly realize, wow, I'm not beholden to anybody, which is sort of scary, because it means I'm responsible for my own life. I have to figure out what I should do about whatever and then do it. I can't run to the nanny state to fix the world. The plus side is I'm beholden to no one. I have no rightful master. I'm just me.
That's a really important point, too, both of those two points. I've said for a long time that the state essentially is a way that individuals can escape the consequences of their actions. So the little old lady next door that would never come over to you and say, you know, that bush is ugly, I don't really like you having that bush in your front yard. She would never do that, but she'll call the city on you and say that your yard is unruly, and they'll come out and force you to trim your bush, you know?
Right. Yeah, and it's profound psychological denial, because if you walk people through it step by step and you say, okay, you're voting for this guy, right? And you know he's going to advocate some sort of tax policy. And you know that means he's going to demand some money from me. And you know that if I don't pay, bad things will happen to me. You walk through it and people, they know every step of the way. They know the literal reality of it. But the obvious conclusion never dawns on them that, okay, so that means you are personally advocating that I be robbed for what you want to have happen. Well, no, I'm not. It's democracy and it's a representative. So they know it and they don't know it at the same time. It's this schizophrenic insanity that lots and lots of good people advocate mass violence. And on one level, they totally know it. They know that the law is not a polite request. It's a threat. Bad things happen to you if you get caught disobeying. And yet they feel no responsibility for personally condoning that, whether it's, you know, warmongering or the war on drugs or, you know, whatever their favorite authoritarian intrusion might be. They know what's happening, but they refuse to accept that they are actually responsible for advocating mass violence. And it's bizarre that people can totally understand that and totally not understand that at the same time.
Yeah, you would think that a person would just look at the body counts alone and realize that, you know, if you added up every mass murderer that's ever lived and every robber and every thief and every bad person that kills another person, if you take all the victims of those bad people and put them in a pile and then just randomly pick a tyrant, the body count alone should cause a person to realize that there is no way you can morally justify the existence of the state.
Yeah, and it's just – it's so hugely lopsided. And I like to make it completely personal and say, well, so you, Mr. Voter, Democrat or Republican, I don't care. It doesn't make any difference. You're telling me that we need government so that I can be protected. So that you're telling me that you're going to vote for somebody to demand my money under threat of violence in order to protect me. You're the one I have to be worried about. You're the threat to my freedom. You're the one who's robbing me. And to say, well, I'm robbing you so that nobody else will, is not a good argument, especially when everybody in the world says that. Like, everybody I know who votes Democrat or Republican is voting for a regime they know is going to forcibly rob me. And they all say, oh, it's so it can protect you from robbers. It's just loony. And yeah, if you just look at the numbers, whether you're talking about murder or assault or kidnapping or theft or torture, you know, pick your favorite crime, see how often it's done in spite of the law, and then see how often it's done in the name of the law. And it'll never even be close. Authority always commits those crimes way more often than private individuals do. And yet people still believe the lie that, well, we need government to keep us civilized. It's like we need this rabid tiger in our living room to keep us safe from any animals that might come in. Just no, you don't make something 1,000 times worse and legitimize evil in the name of protecting people. But people are taught to imagine that that's some rational belief to have.
Even when you consider that if you think about the morality of the foundation of democracy, the idea that one person doesn't have the right to force themselves on you, but three, if they've got, you know, three, that gives a big enough majority, then they can. Well, okay, then if that, then four, how about four, you know?
Right.
It's a leap away from whatever logic is. That's the opposite of it.
Right. And that's a thing I harp on often, is we're taught that democracy is about getting along and it makes us free. Was it Hobbes who described like a stateless society as a war of everyone against everyone? That's what democracy is. It's let's fight over what the club of government is going to be used to bash into our neighbors' heads. That's not peaceful coexistence. It's the exact opposite. When you're voting, you're not saying, I want this guy to go up there, sit in that office and not do anything. You're saying, I want him to tax people and legislate and do this and that and the other thing. And to go through this proper, you know, ritual, very respectable ritual of going into booths and advocating mass violence, it's just this bizarre spectacle to me now of people imagining themselves to be civilized and doing the equivalent of throwing somebody into a volcano for a human sacrifice every month because, well, we have to do this to be civilized. It's just insane. And then I used to do it too. And I look back at what I used to believe and I think, how did I ever hold that idea inside my head as if it's something rational that, well, you have to be robbed in order to protect you from robbers. It's baddie, but I believed it for years because that's what was bashed into my head through the indoctrination.
I'm going to break again and save this file and let our listeners hear another one of our wonderful sponsors. And I'll be right back with you with Larkin Rose.
I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. This is Ben Stone on Bad Quaker Podcast, and with me today is Larkin Rose. Larkin, you had a book a couple years back called The Iron Web. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, that's my first and only novel, and there's an audiobook of it too. And a lot of people were thinking, oh, wow, here's this guy who talks about politics. Now he's pretending he knows how to write a novel. But then it came out and got lots of good reviews from lots of different people who said, wow, I actually liked the story. I thought it was going to be, you know, one of those things where there's sort of this flimsy, lame story to try to hide a, an actual message. But people seemed to actually like the story, and lots of people said, oh, I couldn't put it down, and I never even read novels, but I read this one. And it sneaks in ideas. And to me, the trick of it, I won't give away anything about the story, it follows three characters who are all sort of mainstream, statist, normal Americans that everybody can relate to. It's like, oh, yeah, that's a normal person. It's not one of those weird people who think there shouldn't be government. And then walks them through a story where the situation kind of makes you think about things. And I've been really happy by the response that's received. There's actually somebody posted a YouTube video that's edited piece of something one of the characters said. It's from the audiobook of it. So it's something one of the characters is saying. It leaves out the entire context so you don't get the story. But it's something one of the characters is saying. And it's the character is even less nice than I am. He's rather rude and blunt. The video is titled Message to the Voting Cattle. And I was stunned by how positive a response it got. The likes to dislikes is like 20-1. And the character is not at all nice. He's not civil or polite about it at all. And so I expected 1% to say yay and the other percent to say, wow, that was pretty offensive. But it's been the other way around. And I think maybe that's a hint that with all the political garbage that people have been fed of politicians saying whatever people want to hear, people find it refreshing even when you just hit them over the head with the truth in a completely impolite way. So that's kind of part of the book, one of the characters in the book.
I really like that little piece, and I've shared it with quite a few people. It's a speech, if I recall, it's given in Washington, D.C., isn't it?
Yeah, don't give it away, though.
Oh.
I'm amazed. There's a let's see if I can say this without giving anything away. I'm amazed by how few people, basically nobody has yet claimed to me that they saw the end of the book coming. And I thought some people were going to guess it, but so far, at least nobody has claimed to have guessed it before it happened. So it's a fun story with lots of twists and turns. And I like to do lots of things that you're not supposed to do in a book or a movie just to mess with people's heads. I won't say any, but I kill off the people that you think are going to be there the whole time. And then, and just make it as real as I can so that there aren't invincible heroes and there aren't, the things don't just always magically turn out well for the good guys. It's not like in the movies where it takes 300 bullets to kill the good guy and one ricochet to kill seven bad guys. So I think it's a fun story and a lot of people have really liked it. And it manages to sneak some thinking into people's heads. And some people have told me that they read that book and even that book changed their view of reality, even though it's just a story and mostly still fictional. Pieces of it keep coming true, but most of it's still fiction.
I want to also ask you about there's two specific groups of people that I have in my mind that just absolutely hate you.
Only two? Men and women.
I was thinking of people that you offended when you actually said some pretty normal things that I've heard lots of other people say, and it was in reference to when it's appropriate to defend yourself with lethal violence against authority figures like police.
Right.
You took a ton of heat over that.
Yeah, that was fun. And because I wrote an article, it first appeared on copblock.org called When Should You Shoot a Cop? And the article starts by saying, yeah, I use that title to freak people out. And I know that most people are going to have a tantrum at the title and not bother to read the story. I mean, the story starts by saying that. And then lots and lots of people were nice enough to demonstrate that that was the case by not reading the story and having tantrums, which was pretty funny. The entire point is just to get people. It doesn't even say where my line is. It's just to get people to think, you know, it's some line. You have to decide, I'm not going to go along with evil, even if they call it law. You know, there's something I'm not going to, like, if police show up and say, hi, we're here to kill your family, are you going to say, well, golly, I'm going to sue you next year if you do? Or are you going to say, you're not going to kill my family? And most people, they never want to think about that line at all, because it's not a comfortable topic, you know, talking about having a shootout with anybody, much less somebody with a badge. And I totally did it on purpose to freak people out, because the authoritarian mindset tells them it's never okay to disobey the masters. You can beg and you can vote and you can petition and you can protest, but when the guy with the badge shows up, you do as you're told. And I basically point out, well, you know, look how many really horrible things in history have been a result of people doing as they're told instead of saying, let's resist. So just the question of where do you draw the line at which the guy with the badge is not going to get your obedience, but will actually get forcible resistance. And just the question made so many people freak out, as the story said it was going to. And but it's fun to watch people try to, because I can get anybody in about 2 seconds to name a situation in which it was good to break the law. You know, the Fugitive mm-hmm. Slave Act, or hiding Jews from the Nazis, or, you know, pick your favorite nasty, vicious, totalitarian stunt. And it was legalized before it happened, which means the people who resisted were lawbreakers. You know, Sophie Scholl in The White Rose saying, hey, I think Hitler isn't really that great for Germany, and got her head whacked off. People think, well, in that case, it was okay to resist. But they don't like to think in terms of their own country. Like, okay, what would have to happen on your doorstep before you'd say, I don't care if you call it the law, I'm going to resist. And most people are so averse to even thinking about that, that it's more comfortable for them to have tantrums at me for asking the question than to actually think about what their answer would be.
It's weird, too, because I've been on forums and discussing the very topic that the article that you wrote. And I've been talking with people where they would make the argument in a different in a different setting. They have made the argument that the Holocaust happened because the Jews were in Germany were disarmed and were sheepish and allowed themselves to be taken and allowed themselves to, for these things to be done. And then the same person in a different part of the same forum makes the argument that you absolutely should never resist the police under any circumstances because, you know, and then they have all this list of reasons why you shouldn't.
Right.
And yet they never, and even if you point it out to them, they try to logicalize this in their mind some way to say that one is different than the other. But really the same myth, the same thing down deep in your mind that justifies obeying the cop is exactly what happened in Germany. And somebody might say, oh, no, you're Godwinizing the argument. No, you're using a legitimate aspect of logic to compare two similar things.
Right. And people just don't want to see the principle in their own life. It's easy to point to somebody on the other side of the world in some other time and say he should have resisted, because that doesn't require you to question your own indoctrinated belief in authority. But to think, when should I resist? When should I point a gun at a guy with a badge? Holy smokes. I don't even want to think about it. So I should never do that. Like, you can vote and petition and whine. Those other people should have. The people, you know, the Underground Railroad that broke those laws, the people who hid the Jews and broke those laws, they were good. Yay, I can cheer for them. But if you ask me when I should resist legal tyranny, oh no, that's, I don't even want to think about that. And it's particularly bizarre in this country because every July 4th, everybody's going, yay, 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 at a bunch of people who were cop killers. Like in Battle of Lexington, the police, the law enforcers, the British said, put down your guns. And they said, no. And then had a shootout. And everybody celebrates that on July 4th. But if the exact same thing happened today, all those flag wavers would be the first in line to condemn anybody who said, you can't have my gun. I'm going to shoot you before I'm going to give you my gun, which is what the Battle of Lexington was. But they have this giant disconnect that, like, there's this weird mythology that they can believe in. But if you apply it to real life, no, no, we can't have that.
And believing this mythology that you're talking about here has put us into a situation where open revolution or actual resistance to the government is practically suicide on an individual basis.
Right, because if, you know, if one person, and I talk about this all the time, you know, I'm not suggesting people stand up and fight and get killed for no good reason, because if one person stands up, not only do they have the control freaks and their mercenaries against them, they'll usually have all their neighbors against them too. How dare you resist the law? And so all their neighbors are cheering while they get killed. And that shows the power of the authoritarian indoctrination, that the power of the tyrants is in, as Stephen Biko put it, the most potent weapon in the hand of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Where mm-hmm. if you can convince the people that they're supposed to bow and pay tribute to the rulers, then they're going to enforce your thuggery themselves. If one of their own says, maybe we shouldn't pay, all his neighbors will say, you're a horrible malcontent, evil tax cheat, yada, yada, yada. And when the jackboots come to stomp on you, all your neighbors will cheer for the jackboots because they're so enslaved inside their head while imagining that they're free, that they are willing accomplices to tyranny.
And again, that what you're talking about is not theoretical. This is the practical reality of how the government works. If you consider a very famous case was what happened in Waco. You know, the nation literally cheered the cops and screamed in anger, why didn't you do this earlier? Why are you letting these people stay in there? Why are you allowing this to go on?
You know, I wish you hadn't brought this up, but I feel compelled to admit that I was one of those back then. I was a great law enforcer cheerer back then. I was a mindless statist back then. And at least at the beginning, I thought, just go in and get those criminals. And now I'm just, I could not be more embarrassed and ashamed that I ever thought that and that I ever advocated such a thing, because I was so delusional. I really thought, hey, they disobeyed authority, they must be bad, go get them. And I make myself confess these things in the hope that other people will see, oh yeah, maybe I should give that up too. Because I wasn't born understanding, you know, what I know now. I was, well, actually I was born understanding it, and then it was indoctrinated out of me for years and years. But I did the same stupid authoritarian cheering for evil that I see lots of other people doing. Just because you're doing it today doesn't mean you have to do it tomorrow. And I'm glad I eventually outgrew it, and I'm really embarrassed it took so long. But yeah, so I've been on both sides of that. And I used to think the drug war was a good thing. Yay, lock up people for smoking a plant. Just now it's just, and joke's on me. When I was political prisoner for a year for not paying tribute to the IRS, I got to meet lots of the victims of my past stupidity who were in a cage because they were selling pot to make money to feed their families. And I got to see firsthand, wow, here is what I was actually advocating. Here's the reality of it. Good people living in cages because of some stupid idea that I don't particularly like that habit. Maybe people should be caged for doing it. And so, you know, joke's on me. I got to see firsthand the results of my past stupid statism. And maybe if everybody did that, they'd change their mind.
Jail is good.
Right. It's a good unindoctrinating process.
Well, this brings up the other thing that I mentioned that has drawn hate towards you is your tax protest experiences. This has caused maybe not with the same level of anger as the cop thing did, but I've seen it over and over that they want to classify you as some kind of a nut, or they throw you into a bucket with a bunch of other tax protesters that really are nuts, or they just think that you're horribly evil because you would disobey like that.
Yeah, there's some seriously frothing anger there. I think it rises to the level of the response to when should you shoot a cop. And it's interesting because for me, you know, I came from the tax honesty movement, whatever you want to call it. I came from a neutral position saying, oh, I'm hearing about these claims, I'm going to look into them. And I look into one and find that, well, they're actually misrepresenting stuff or misreading stuff. And one after another, I found that to be the case. And then I came across one having to do with law itself and found that, whoa, it actually doesn't say what I always thought it did. And I hardly even bother talking about that anymore because nobody seems to care. Like, the authoritarians don't care what the law says. And the other people don't care what it says because it's politician scribbles. And who cares? Ultimately, it's a trivial irrelevancy. But just coming into it and saying, hey, look what I found. And the amount of venom from the extortion apologists at anybody who says, wait a minute, this doesn't actually match what I already always assumed the law said. And you're a tax protester and a scam artist and a good scam artist. I gave away my findings for free. I got to work on my scam artist skills. But just frothing at the mouth. And that's still up there. If you do a search, for my name, one of the top things. And I think somebody is skewing the results because there can't be that many people looking that up. But it's like this horrible, let's see, I was called a human cockroach. That was a nice one. A tax cheat. Incidentally, I was convicted of misdemeanor, willful failure to file. It wasn't even tax evasion. It wasn't even a felony. It was, you didn't send us a piece of paper. But the amount, even in the trial, they didn't bother to try to prove I had committed a crime. They just said, oh, he's this horrible person. And if everybody did that, that's the end of the world. Ah. And so just this bizarre gut reaction. And it was so, when I was being a political prisoner, I got to read a bunch of writings of Frederick Douglass, who used to be a slave. And man, could I relate to the part where he described the fact that, you know, some of the slaves thought they were supposed to be slaves, and they would view a runaway slave as a thief for trying to steal himself from the master. And I thought, wow, that's the American people. And it never occurred to me, you know, I am all my life imagining that the slaves are all sitting around thinking this is horrible and evil, and the first chance we get to run away, we will. A lot of them weren't like that. They had been convinced that they were supposed to be slaves and that it was virtuous to serve their masters, to pay their fair share, and to see how that's still the American mentality, and the amount of people who spewed venom at me just for, and I didn't resist on philosophical grounds. It was, you know, I totally respect people who do that, who say, I'm not going to fund your war machine or whatever, I'm not paying. I just did it based on, hey, look what your laws actually say. And in what should be just an academic discussion, whether I'm right or wrong, so many people just frothing at the mouth and were ready to lynch me on the spot for saying, hey, wait, look what the law actually says. It's just an amazing revelation on the mindset of the peasantry who really take pride in being law-abiding taxpayers. That's one of my favorite terms. Like, people wear that label with pride. It means I do what the politicians tell me to and I give them my money. And why anybody would wear that as a badge of pride, I'm not sure. But most people still do. And they're so angry at anybody who wouldn't pay tribute to the gods in Washington that they just foam at the mouth and call me everything you could possibly imagine and wish death on me and all sorts of nice things. Because, and oddly, it's not just because I didn't want to be robbed, it's because I didn't want them to be robbed either. And so I often sum up what I do is go around telling people you should be free. And what most of them do is say, no, I shouldn't, which is kind of a depressing hobby to have, but that's what it is. I tell people that they should be free, and they insist that they shouldn't be free, and neither should I. But slowly, lots and lots of people are coming around to realize, oh yeah, maybe I should be free. Maybe everybody should be free.
That's a great note to end this interview on. And Larkin, I really appreciate you coming on the show with me. If I don't see you before then, I'm assuming you're going to get to the next Pork Fest.
I believe so.
If possible, I'm going to find a way to fight through the crowd and get up and shake your hand and say hi to you. But I really do appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
And folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, as always, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks.